Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome everybody for yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We have special guests today. Not only do we have Daan Struiven, who is co-head of commodities research at Goldman Sachs, but we also have my daughter attending. She's doing a one-day internship and she's part of the preparation of the podcast. And I told her, this is a nice analogy for the commodities space. Always something unexpected happens. It's a bit of a chaos and then you need to adapt. And that is what is working in the commodities industry is all about.
And you would be the first person that actually has been in contact with commodities before they even start studying. Most of people's coincidence. So
yeah, to give myself or to give the audience but a brief introduction of Daan. How did I find out Daan? As it was either CNBC or LinkedIn where I saw an interview with someone from Goldman Sachs. And then I was ecstatic about it because then I realized he was the head of commodities research of Goldman. And I thought, well, that would be fantastic to have him in our podcast. And the fact that he is active in the media, that should be a good omen. So I sent him a LinkedIn immediately and I thought, no chance. But Daan responded very enthusiastically and here we are.
Here he is.
So thank you, Daan, and thank you also, Goldman, for participating in the podcast.
Pleasure. No, thank you for having me and it's great to meet you both and to meet your daughter.
So, Daan. Yeah, I'm also very excited because, you know, for me, if you talk about Goldman, it's somehow a standard, it's a name, it's a brand. So you must be very smart, very good at what you do because they probably have a lot of applications for your role. So I'm really excited about this conversation. It's great to have you here. I'm looking forward to your story. How did you end up in the world of commodities?
Yeah, great. Yeah, so thanks for having me. So yeah, what's the story? How did I get into commodities? I think I have to start with the beginnings. I'm really passionate about economics and in particular, this sort of intersection of micro and macroeconomics. That's what I did when I did my PhD in economics in Boston at MIT. It was a close call after the PhD degree, whether I would become a teacher, whether I would teach economics or join the private sector. But what pulled me over the line was the prospect of working, a broad range of topics at a high pace in a high energy environment with a team. And yeah, I think that's highly energizing. And ultimately went with my gut feeling and did not go the academic route. And decided to go for the Goldman research team, where I initially started on the economics team, and then over time transitioned into the commodities research team, which is truly a terrific seat. The team has a great tradition, and it's a privilege, a challenge, and a lot of fun to keep expanding our coverage with all of challenges ahead.
In the introduction, we talked about the Goldman brand. Now, it is known for being one of the best, if not the best, investment banks in the world. But I also know it has a commodities franchise. But can you explain to our audience what that commodities franchise does and what its purpose is, maybe in terms of proprietary trading or advising clients? So what is the role and how does it fit in the overall Goldman franchise?
Great. Yeah, so Goldman entered the commodities business in 1981 when Goldman acquired J. Aron. Today, it operates as a fully integrated global commodities business that offers various services to clients, three services in particular, risk management, primarily helping corporates to manage their commodity price risk exposure. Second, physical trading and logistics. And third, also help clients to raise funding, increasingly through structured finance products. The business is active in 10 offices across the world. The Goldman commodities franchise trades about 60 commodities or so. And I think the beauty of the business is that we serve both corporate and we learn honestly so much from the corporate clients about production outlook, about demand, because the data quality in commodities is imperfect. So you just learn so much from talking to these corporates on the one hand. And then we also talk to institutional clients, basically asset managers, pension funds, hedge funds, banks who think about commodities in portfolios to hedge inflation risk or to go for diversification or to express views on the fundamental commodities outlook. And I think the commodities business at Goldman has stood the test of time. Actually, the prior CEO of Goldman, he grew up in the commodities J.Aron business. Lloyd Blankfein. I think the first female leader of the global Goldman trading business was also coming from the commodities business. And so the business keeps evolving as global commodity markets continue to evolve. But I think there's a very strong institutional memory and a strong commitment to the commodities business at Goldman.
And does Goldman has him where you say, well, because 60 commodities, it's big, right? And a lot. So do you have a specific set where you say, well, that's where we are really strong and that's where we put the majority of the resources in? Is more on the energy side? Is more on the soft commodities? Is it?
Yeah, maybe I should speak from the perspective of the research team. We are about 10 research analysts, and yeah, we want to have a high impact per, you know, per colleague. And so we focus on the commodities where we think, you know, we can have a comparative advantage. And so I think the commodities that where our research team is the most focused on are energy, so both oil and natural gas in the US and globally, base metals, especially copper and ali, increasingly battery metals as well, precious metals, especially gold, which is my favorite commodity at the moment, my favorite long commodity, and I hope we can talk about it more. And then finally, we're also focused on sort of the role of commodities in portfolios, cross-commodity research, and how it all fits into the broader macro business cycle that that we track for investors. So those are the commodities we are the most focused on and spend the vast majority of our resources on with our team of roughly 10 colleagues here on the research side.
Hey, that's already a huge amount of great information. Now, I made two notes about that research and asset class. And I also receive myself regularly questions from people interested in the commodities trade. So how do you do research? Now, as an example, what you just said, you learned a lot from talking to clients. Mm-hmm. And I recognize that. Talking to suppliers and talking to users of commodities. The challenge I have always experienced as translating anecdotal data into actionable data. And to give a simple example, you can analyze listed companies that come with their quarterly results. They provide a lot of information. Or you talk to them, as you said. Okay. But then how do you make sure that in a structured way, you bring all that information together at the end of the day, impacting the S&D? Because on the trading desk, that is what I was always interested in. At the end of the day, the research people, they need to come up with an analysis which makes a change in the S&D and then enables me as a trader to assess the impact on price. And that can be for proprietary trading, or it can be for risk management. And also, I guess in the case of Goldman, it can be to assess, for example, the margin development of those companies that have exposure to commodities, whether it is agricultural commodities as ingredients or maybe crude oil for energy, things like that. So the question is, and it strikes me as well that the team is 10 analysts, it doesn't sound like a huge amount. How do you make these analytics and transfer anecdotal stuff into the S&D analytics that Goldman has?
Yeah, so I think, and I can take the example of oil, I think you really need, in addition to feedback from clients, you need three analytical key pieces. One is, I think, a pricing framework.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think that's where comparative advantage is.
Yeah.
Yes, you can have the most accurate S&D projection or inventory projection possible, but ultimately, clients want to know what's the outlook for prices and what are the risks to prices. And for instance, in the case of oil, our pricing framework is relatively simple. We break down sort of the spot futures Brent price, crude oil price, into the sum of two pieces. The cyclical components, basically time spreads, spot prices minus long versus long dated prices, which tend to rise when commodities are scarce. So that's really tied to our inventory path. That is the structural part of the price. Sorry, the cyclical part of the price. And then on the structural side, we analyze the global cost curve and try to figure out what's the marginal cost of production for the last barrel that allows to balance supply and demand. So I think the starting point is the pricing framework, which varies across commodities. But for energy, it's really driven by physical balances typically. But the second thing you need is a good sense of realized official data. And there are a lot of imperfections. We, for instance, on the oil side, we start from the IEA data, but they're not perfect and they're lagged. They're subject to revisions. For instance, oil demand tends to be underestimated by 0.5% or so if you look at data 5 years after the first release. And then the third thing you need, I think, is a forecasting model in combination with nowcasts, because the official data are lagged. we love to use high-frequency data to figure out where are we right now. And then, of course, you also need a forecasting framework, where on the demand side, we would, for instance, forecast oil demand both top-down from a GDP and price perspective, but also bottom-up, adding up the refined product demand outlooks. So I think those are the three analytical backbones. But then we use client insights as cross-checks on the forecast. For instance, I want to be humble. It's hard from New York to have an edge in terms of the China demand outlook. And so I learned so much from speaking to the refiners in terms of the forward-looking outlook. And so I think these conversations are cross-checks on what the models generate for the outlook. And we also learn a lot about, for instance, the cost structure and the production outlook from the U.S. shale producers that we speak very regularly to. And both in oil and gas, we think the U.S. shale producers are the marginal suppliers. So that's a very helpful data point as well. But I would see them as qualitative complements to the sort of three quantitative backbones that that we just discussed.
No, that's great. And then the system. And you know, you may know the memes and, you know, sometimes the jokes that the whole financial industry still depends on Excel, right? And I used to make my own S&Ds in Excel, and I will not mention any names, but to my surprise, some also companies outside of Cargill are still heavily dependent on Excel. What kind of setup do you work with in order to gather your global S&Ds and also the interfaces that you provide to the users of your research within the firm?
Yeah, so we're super focused on Pythonizing our commodity research infrastructure using Python. I think it's a software that is sort of a jack of all trades. It can gather data from very heterogeneous data sources. It can do econometrics. It can do data visualization. You can generate, for instance, our nowcasts on our portal that are updated every day. So I feel like you can do a lot with Python, and our analysts are all investing very significantly, both in their human capital by writing the code, but also in the infrastructure for our team and for our clients. That said, a lot of clients love Excel. Excel is great to cross-check, you know, what Python generates. And so I think you really want to use both. You want to build automated infrastructure, but you also want to use Excel because clients love it and for simple cross-checks. So I think they're not mutually exclusive. They're actually reinforcing each other.
Oh, good.
But does that mean as well that you, in the skill set of a researcher, started evolving over time, right? Because I think not everybody maybe in the beginning had also Python skills.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, and the most important skills are still the same. I think you need a good microeconomic intuition. You need a passion for markets. You need to be a team player. But yes, over time, the importance of Python and data science and econometrics, at least on our team, has gone up significantly.
And is there also an element where you go out into the market? Eh? So you go to the crops, or you go to the traders, you visit conferences. Is there a way where you also go out into this, or you stay behind the screen and do everything there?
No, it's very much the back and forth between focusing on research notes, presenting them, getting feedback, getting actually new questions clients are asking. So I think it's the combination that makes our seed fun and the work productive. And yeah, the more years you spend on the research team, the less hours you spend coding, and the more hours you spend engaging with clients, gather feedback to sort of generate the ideas for the next research note.
Because one of the things when I was talked to a trading company's research team, smaller than yours, but they said, we get so much requests from the internal teams that we have very little time basically to do our own analysis, things that we may want to improve on the system, improve on base standard analysis that they do. Do you experience that as well? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's, you always want to balance investing for the long run and serving clients in the short term. But I think infrastructure very much helps on both fronts. And so, yeah, we're super focused on automating our tools. And as clients come in, we can immediately share the chart, immediately share the tool. But yeah, I think you need a bit of discipline to make sure you have enough time to build the tools and do the fundamental work, which ultimately will be great for clients, maybe not tomorrow, but in 3 months, 6 months, top on.
Yeah.
One other thing you talked about is commodities as an asset class. Now, and I find that a super interesting topic, because it is a topic on a regular basis in the media, whether it's CNBC or, you know, LinkedIn. Now, what always surprises me is that commodities are almost like generalized as an asset class, like an index you can sit in an investor, like the S&P 500 index. Now, and I have given a lot of presentations also in New York to pension funds. And I was talking about vegetable oil and I was talking about cocoa. And I always thought, well, what the hell are these people doing? Why would they invest in commodities that I saw as a trade, as a short to medium trade, not as a kind of a long-term investment, like, for example, stocks? Now, okay, that was my view. And then interestingly, I think two or three years ago, a former colleague, friend, professor, Ivo Sojanovic, he said, Martijn, I'm writing a book about this very topic, and the book is called Commodities as an Asset Class. It's not a big book. You read it in 2 days. The essence is actually confirming my theory that commodities are a trade and not a long-term investment. Now, who better than you can provide a credible view about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. So yeah, I read the online summary of the book actually to prepare this podcast. Mm. Thanks for pointing it out, and I look forward to reading the book. I agree with the view that commodities are not always universally reliable as hedges against inflation, and that the performance tends to be very significantly influenced by sort of the commodity-specific supply and demand fundamentals. That said, I think there is a role for commodities in portfolios, but I think you want to be tactical about it and thinking about the optimal share as a function of, you know, the supply-demand outlook on the commodity side and as a function of the macro outlook. I think there are three potential contributions from commodities to portfolios. One is as an inflation hedge. You do find just empirically that when inflation, you know, is high, for instance, US core PC, which excludes food and energy, is above 3%, that commodities indices tend to outperform other asset classes, including bonds, equities, tips, and other real assets like real estate. That's kind of an empirical finding, but the economics also make sense. If you think about how economists explain inflation, they sort of explain inflation based on three potential sources. Negative supply shocks, very often commodities cause the negative supply shocks. Positive demand shocks, and usually when demand is very strong, when the economy has been overheated for a long time, commodity inventories tend to be low because demand has been exceeding supply for a long time, and low inventories tend to drive both spot returns and carry returns. And then the third type of inflation that economists sort of think about is the idea of runaway inflation. Central banks no longer control inflation expectations. And in that scenario, I think assets such as gold, which have a long history of sort of maintaining their real value, also have a role. But I think you want to think about what is the inflation risk you want to hedge against yourself. You want to insure yourself against? What are the, you know, commodity-specific supply and demand outlooks? Like, while historically oil is the best inflation hedge, averaging across different shocks, across different years, at the moment, there's a lot of spare capacity. So it's just, in my view, difficult to see a lot of price upside to oil that is sustained. Yes, in the short term, you could see a spike, maybe because of lower Iran supply or lower Russian supply. But over time, I would think that the high spare capacity would lead countries such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE to raise production, sort of offset tightening effects. So I think the reality is nuanced. There is a role for commodities in portfolios. And I think the three potential contributions from commodities to portfolios are inflation hedging, as we discussed, diversification, where the correlation with bonds and equities turns negative, either when you have negative supply shocks or late in the business cycle. But again, you want to see where are you in the macro cycle and where are you in the commodity cycle. And then third, and a lot of clients are focused on that, there is a role for carry, the so-called roll yield, the idea that you can generate basically returns by exploiting the fact that a lot of the commodity futures curves are sort of downward sloping. So you essentially sell high and buy low as you roll down the futures curve. But again, that depends on the commodity. Oil tends to be positive carry, natural gas tends to be negative carry. So again, I think the devil is in the details. There is definitely a significant role for commodities in portfolios, but I think a data-driven and nuanced approach is the right one.
What is then, looking at all this, where you are researching all the data, now, one of the big topics is AI. So how do you at Goldman use AI basically for your department?
Yeah, maybe to zoom out a bit, also the question of what AI means for commodities is one of the most popular questions we're getting. And I think that, the first order impact is it's going to be positive for commodities demand, both via higher GDP and higher income. For instance, our economists estimate that U.S. growth 10 years from now will be 0.4% higher than it would be in the absence of AI. And then, of course, a lot of the demand is going to come in the power sector, where, for instance, our equity research colleagues estimate that in the US, for the first time in 3 decades, power demand growth will outpace GDP growth. Power demand has been pretty much flat over the last 25 years, and they forecast a very sharp acceleration on the back of not only AI demand, but also broader electrification trends such as EVs. And so I think it reinforces, for instance, the constructive outlook we have for U.S. natural gas in the next 2 years, both because you have higher demand for U.S. natural gas as all these LNG export terminals shipping U.S. gas to the rest of the world come online, and because of the additional boost from higher power demand. But I think one potentially underappreciated impact on commodity markets is AI may well boost supply. And we, for instance, estimated that on the oil side, you could perhaps see a negative impact on prices of about $5 per barrel if AI reduces costs via improved logistics, better resource allocation, and perhaps we could even boost the ultimately recoverable base. Shale currently only gets 10% of the oil out of the ground. If you can lift that number, supply could be higher, energy would be more abundant, and perhaps prices on the oil side would be lower. And we barely use oil for power. And so our view generally is that if you're constructive on AI demand, I think that regional power markets are your best trade, because we're really seeing that the data centers are incredibly regionally concentrated in places like Virginia, Texas, in part because the regulatory climate is more friendly. Second, I would say natural gas, although the LNG cycle is the more important driver. And honestly, I don't think that oil or copper are the best AI trades. If you look at copper, estimated AI accounts for less than 2% of global copper demand. And then within Goldman, we're very focused on experimenting with AI, but we're also very focused on making sure the research is accurate. There's no substitute for checking and human control. And second, we're also very focused on making sure that our data and our clients' data don't leave Goldman, and that
because
protects
you
the
see that it, because I think what you said on point A one, what does it mean for commodities, and I think with the data centers, I think it's a massive one, but supply is a funny one. But actually, on the experimenting with AI, right, how you do that within Goldman, and people, when I look at my business, Vesper, people say, okay, what can you do with AI on forecasting? Can we determine what's the price going to be for palm oil or for sugar? But we see also that AI is still basically a bit of a black box. Yes, the results of the forecast are better than the old-fashioned way of forecasting, but you don't know what happened inside that black box, right? Yes, how do you experience that?
Yeah, I think it's very important for research to be based on a transparent framework. Clients are interested in our price forecast, but usually the interest is bigger in what's your framework. Oh, I may have a very different assumptions on tariffs and the U.S. economic outlook or on China, but I want to know how I translate my views, my assumptions into the price outlook. And so I think the transparency of the framework is really essential. And the other thing is we usually work with small samples. Maybe in agriculture, you have very long samples, but in a lot of energy markets, we have small samples. And so maybe the model, perhaps by overfitting the data, works better in sample. But we are interested in the future. That's by design, an out-of-sample forecasting exercise. So again, I see it as a complement, but I don't think there's a substitute for very transparent and logical forecasting frameworks that are grounded in microeconomics.
I think what you also said is important. And we are receiving questions from audience who not only ask the impact on humans on the research side, but also on the commodity trading side. And what you said, I think is spot on, is that you don't necessarily want to trust the system blindly. So you need people who will be able to assess the outcome and say, well, this looks very weird. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing is also in research teams and the interaction between research teams and traders and maybe analysts of stocks of companies is in constantly challenging each other and doing the opposite of accepting the outcome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very often as humans, as we do on purpose, take the other side.
Selfie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And be the devil's advocate.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think, AI can maybe, probably help dramatically with analyzing huge data sets and making analysis more efficient. But I think you still need humans who actually understand what happens under the hood. And like, for example, like I do with when I'm doing the shopping in the retail, I look at what's happening in the chocolate shelf, and I look at what's happening on the coffee shelf.
Yeah.
And you see the coffee shelf is empty. Why? Is there no coffee anymore? Yeah, there is coffee, but there is a huge fight between the retailer and the producer. Mm. Yeah, and that has an impact on both their margins eventually. Now, that's how is an AI, maybe a robot at some stage, you send out doing some shopping. But I think there is a, similar to what you said about Excel, it's complementary. So AI will help humans, but humans are still needed to raise the critical questions or prompts, as they are called now.
And as always, we'll free up time for analysts to work on, you know, the next most interesting question.
Yeah,
because I think you said
the patients that we have today did not exist after the Second World War. So yeah, you free up resources to work on new questions, new developments, and you know, we'll figure out the more interesting thing to work on if our analysts don't have to do a lot of time consuming manual work.
Yeah, Dan, I have a question for you regarding one of the things that you said in the beginning was like, yeah, one of my favorites is gold, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, so
at least right now,
at least right now. So, you know, people always said, you know, when you invest your money somewhere, you know, you can do it in real estate or you can go to gold because it's steady, it's there, it has limited amount because it's a natural product. I would love to know a bit more about the world of gold. You know, we have not we've spoken about a lot of commodities in this podcast, but I think not about gold yet. So can you tell us a bit about the world, the commodity gold?
Yeah, no, I think everything you said is spot on. Gold has a long history of sort of maintaining its real value on average across many centuries. It also, you know, has pretty constrained supply. But what's unique since 2022 is that we have seen a surge in gold demand from central banks. And that's really what drives this massive rally we have seen over the last couple of years. So what happened in 22 is that Russia's central bank reserves of US treasuries or European bonds got frozen. And so reserve managers of EM central banks across the world realized, maybe my fixed income here is not that fixed, is not that safe. It was a wake-up call. And we saw a five-fold increase in central bank purchases of gold since mid-22. And this is not going to go away. EM reserves of gold are still quite low as a share of total reserves, and if you compare it to central banks in developed markets. And while the traditional sort of gold pricing framework explaining gold price changes with changes in rates visibly broke down in 22, once you account for this jump in demand from central banks, you know, we designed a model that explains roughly 70% of the monthly price changes in gold prices, basically adding up the demand from three groups. Traditionally, the ETFs, which are very much related to interest rates, speculators, basically hedge funds, COMEX net positioning, and then third, the new source of demand, the game changer, central bank demand that is difficult to measure, but we use customs data to sort of build a nowcast of monthly central bank buying. So the beauty is you do well in the base case because of higher structural central bank buying. And on top of that, icing on the cake, it's a good hedge, for instance, against tariff escalation, because tariff escalation means higher uncertainty. And when uncertainty is high, speculators tend to go to gold, park their funds until clarity in broader markets is achieved.
And so for this, what I found so interesting is that gold keeps its value or over many years, but the real demand of gold, the price of gold is set by the demand of consumers, right? Of somebody that wants to have a gold ring or the gold necklace and we want to pay for that amount, right? So can you explain me like what I see as well? Because I see that there is a trend of younger generation that spend more money, less on more money on experiences and less money on the physical need of stuff, of whatever they want to have, a car or, you know, expensive clothes or whatever, but more on experiences. Could it be that therefore people care less about having a gold necklace, but more would rather spend that money on an amazing experience or an amazing holiday or a travel, whatever? Is that because, help me to understand that the money, the value of gold is because we want to buy it and have it in our home and use it on our necks and fingers and everything.
Yeah. So I think where you're getting at is highly relevant over a longer horizon.
Yeah.
But if you want to forecast gold prices next month or 1 year ahead, the vast majority of purchases are really driven by either central banks, ETF investors, or hedge funds. I think that gold purchases are much more slow moving. I mean, how many times in your life do you buy a wedding band? You know, one, perhaps two times. But the three sort of demand sources that I described, they're actively trading on a daily, weekly, quarterly basis. And as all models, our model is imperfect, but you need to abstract from things that are quantitatively less important. And so we find that those three sort of higher frequency sources really help to explain the bulk of gold price changes. And then the second point I would make is that, yeah, maybe we are seeing that in the West, the share of consumer expenditure spent on gold is declining somewhat. If you go to places like India or China, the demand outlook is really strong. And actually, if you sort of move up the GDP per capita curve, gold spending as a share of income tends to rise. And if you think that we're in a world with more uncertainty about the structural outlook of the Chinese economy, uncertainty about the value of the dollar in a polarizing world, you could argue that demand for gold will be even higher than what sort of traditional GDP per capita models predict. The Goldman Commodities franchise trades about 60. Ultimately, I think that
system improve on base standard analysis that they do. Do you experience that as well? And how do you deal with that?
What I would like to understand about gold is how does that central bank buying work, actually? Can you explain how central banks buying gold, how does that actually work?
Mm-hmm. Great. So they primarily buy on the London over-the-counter OTC market. What we've seen in the data over the last few years is that sort of the growth in reserves, which are on the asset side of central bank's balance sheet, has been primarily met by growing gold reserves, as opposed to ramping up the value of your, say, US Treasury or German bund holding. So it's, it is a gradual diversification, not driven by outright selling of, say, US Treasuries, but by a gradual allocation of the incremental growth in reserves to gold.
But what they, you say over the counter, but they hold they hold physical, not?
I always think of that big building, big something very secure where they have a lot of gold. That's always my view of counters.
Yes, London is really the epicenter of this.
Okay, look, I'm not a specialist at this part, but that's why I like talking to you. How does that work? Because the gold standard is long gone. There is no link between the amount of money in supply and it's not backed by gold. So what is the reason that a central bank, which is not a hedge fund, why are they buying gold?
Yeah, because they want to prevent what happened to Russia in 22 or to Libya before, where you thought that your, say, US Treasury reserves were safe, but then you enter a conflict with other countries, for instance, the US and the European Union and other G7 countries, and they decide to seize your reserves, and then your reserves are no longer valuable. In fact, 10 days ago, there was an article in the FT suggesting that several European countries, not only France, but for instance, also Germany, are increasingly considering to not only freeze the treasury reserves, but also to seize them, perhaps to fund security guarantees for Ukraine after potential ceasefire. And so I think central banks want to avoid a repetition of what happened in 1922, because gold holdings can't be frozen or seized if you hold them yourself
in a vault.
It's basically the most secure thing to do. They if you don't trust anybody, you can better just hold gold and then just sit on it. Because the rest is all in the air or online in paperwork, etc. Somewhere. Yeah, that's exactly a risk.
Okay. I'd like to go back to oil. And there's something that I wanted to ask already for a long time. And you have in Holland, maybe in other European countries as well, you have this movement, and they're called Just Stop Oil. It's a climate movement. And I always think, well, look, this is a very, is it not a realistic thing to expect, knowing that oil is everything? It is the energy powering everything that moves. It is clothing. It's basically everything in life is energy, is to a large extent still oil. Now, we also know decades ago that there were all kinds of alarming, you know, news that we're going to run out of oil. We have never actually run out of oil. If you look at where prices are now, they're well off all-time highs. I think at the time, the Canadian tar sands and the U.S. shale gas wasn't really a news item. There's always something new, apparently, in terms of finding more supply. Now, what do you think in terms of, and that is a question that we also get a lot, what is the impact of the growth of renewables on oil? How far can you look ahead in order to be able to say something about how long the world is still dependent on oil? Yeah. Is that 10 years? Is that 50 years? And when is the scale going to tip whereby alternatives, and it can be wind, solar, maybe nuclear, is going to take over from oil? The real long-term changes in trends, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, so most of our work sort of focus on the outlook over the next 2 years, but we have done some work trying to look further ahead. And of course, the longer the forecast horizon, the greater the uncertainty. But our work sort of suggests that we have probably another decade of growth ahead for global oil demand, with a peak probably around 2034 or so, and then a long plateau, no collapse. And that will be consistent with the history of energy transitions. And I say transitions plural, because if you, for instance, look at global coal consumption, its share is starting to edge down, despite very rapid growth in China and India. But so far, all the new energy sources we have invented, after coal, initially oil, then natural gas, then power, renewables, typically are on top. They're additive, rather than necessarily replacing. And I think there are, you know, two pretty big challenges with the idea that oil demand is going to fall off a cliff anytime soon. Number one is global total energy needs will continue to rise. We, for instance, estimate that the number of cars that the world will buy is going to rise 40% or so by 2040, with massive growth in the number of cars in places like India. And the second challenge is that the availability of cheap, affordable, scalable alternatives to oil depends on where you are in the barrel. Yes, in terms of road transportation, if you look at China, it's going very fast. More than 50% of new car sales in China are EVs. And we're actually also seeing pretty important rises in LNG, liquid natural gas powered trucks in China. So the road transportation part of the barrel, which is about half of global oil demand, there things are, you know, are transitioning year by year. But oil demand depends on the stock of gas and diesel powered cars. It doesn't depend on the change. And so even there, even if it's the part of the barrel that is switching the most quickly, it's going to take time.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, if you, for instance, look at jet fuel or petrochemicals, we currently don't have cheap, scalable, affordable alternatives. For instance, we estimate that jet fuel is still four times less expensive than sustainable aviation fuels. We haven't really figured out scalable, cheaper alternatives to plastic. So some parts of the barrel, we think, will continue to grow for, you know, many, many years, and other parts of the barrel will see declines. If you add it all up across countries with DMs declining, EMs rising across different refined products, our best is, you know, working assumption is that you rise another decade and then move along a pretty long and flat plateau for many years.
So just up oil is really a mirage, right? It's impossible.
Why?
You can't stop it.
What do you mean?
Just stop oil. The slogan, just stop oil.
It's a resource in the world, right? So it's somehow we hit the bottom of oil, right? It's not.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think the peak will probably come from the demand side as engineers and perhaps policymakers find more affordable alternatives. And for instance, on the EV side, now in China, EVs are typically cheaper than gasoline-powered cars, following both technological progress and a big policy push. If you look at the power sector, but we don't use a lot of oil for power, except in countries like, you know, the Middle East and parts of Africa. But in the case of power, for instance, the solar panel revolution is going very, very fast, with costs dropping 20% whenever global production doubles, and global production continues to double. So I think you want to be nuanced. There's no such thing as the energy transition. It depends on the technologies. It depends on the countries. And it depends on sort of the part of the energy demand curve that you're trying to satisfy.
Yeah.
50% more cars. I found it already very busy on the streets. We even get more cars. Jesus.
Yeah, not necessarily a lot more in the Netherlands, but yeah, mostly in places like India, Africa.
Okay. Hey,
I have there's two important topics that I'd still like to cover because everyone is talking about them, and that is the Russia-Ukraine situation and potential end to the hostilities, is maybe first a ceasefire, but then eventually stopping, and maybe linked to that a little bit, the tariffs, and with you know the new U.S. administration. Now, the interesting thing about the Russia-Ukraine war was we had an energy crisis, and we had the Dutch TTF gas market reaching totally insane levels, which led to European and UK governments to impose price caps. Fortunately, it wasn't needed due to a mild winter. And also people like me putting their temperature at 18 degrees in the winter and enjoying blankets and cozy situation with the family under the blanket. And we had also a huge disruption of agricultural commodities like wheat. And I think a lot of people didn't realize, for example, also how important Ukraine was for aluminium, for example. No. And you said that you've done a lot of study on that, what the impact on commodities may be if after 3 years the Russia-Ukraine war comes to an end. Could you share some of that research?
Perfect.
So that we can...
So I would contrast European and global natural gas, where a potential significant return of Russian natural gas volumes would basically pull forward the end of the energy crisis, that in our base case, we're forecasting to occur in 2027, once all these US and Qatari LNG cargoes reach the world and provide ample natural gas. I want to contrast the potentially very big price downside on the European natural gas side with more limited effects for most other commodities, whether it's oil, coal, metals. Why? Because the sanctions on Russia have mostly led to a rerouting of supply of oil, coal, and most metals, as opposed to a drop in global exports from Russia to the rest of the world. For instance, in the case of oil, the most important client for Russian oil producers were the Europeans. Europe barely buys any Russian oil, but it's now going to China, India, and Turkey. And so the constraint on Russian oil production, in our view at the moment, is self-imposed. It's OPEC plus quota agreements between Moscow, Riyadh, and the other partners. And so if you were to see a ceasefire and a hypothetical release of sanctions on Russia in the oil sector, you wouldn't see, in our view, a boost in Russian production. At the margin, prices could still fall somewhat because you have currently 60 million barrels of oil on water that are sort of in excess of the normal level because the trading rounds are longer than usual. And so if you go back to shorter routes, those barrels are released, and it's a little bit like the release of a strategic petroleum reserve, and prices go down somewhat. And on top of that, you could also have an indirect negative effect on demand for oil if, for instance, much lower natural gas prices incentivize, for instance, trucks in China to switch more quickly out of diesel into natural gas, reducing diesel demand, reducing oil demand, and reducing oil prices. But we're really talking about maybe $5 per barrel of downside to oil, in contrast with TTF, where you're currently in the mid-40s per euro per megawatt hour, where you could fall to basically 20 euros per megawatt hour if the flows that used to come from Russia to Ukraine were to return to pre-2022 level. And so basically, the European energy crisis that in our base case ends in 27 would end pretty much in 2020.
That's good news because I need to renew my utilities contract. And I have been anticipating the end of the war for that. So that is a great outlook. If my gas price is cut by 50%. That's nice. I can spend it on other things.
Well, maybe a little
gold.
Money for
I'm
going to
go
for
gold,
daughter,
gold necklace.
You
know? Yeah. No, that is very interesting. Thanks a lot for that. And then the tariffs.
I had a question in general, yeah, like, because I see the tariffs as kind of a black swan event because nobody could see it coming, etc. And there are more of these kind of events like wars, COVID, etc. And in research, I mean, this is unfortunately what you have to deal with in general, black swan events. So how do you deal with that? And tariffs is one of them, right?
Or COVID.
Yeah. Pricing frameworks and scenario analysis. But here's the base case, but here's a pricing framework to think about tariff shocks, to think about OPEC plus reaction function shocks, to think about Russia-Ukraine shocks. I think ultimately clients put a lot of value on the framework and the range of potential outcomes.
Yeah.
I don't think our team has a comparative advantage in predicting what negotiations between Putin, Zelensky and Trump will ultimately deliver. But I think our comparative advantage should be, how do you think about these risks from a pricing perspective?
Yeah.
But the mechanics of the tariffs, because that I also struggle a bit with that. You know, Trump sees it as a revenue. At least it seems like he sees it as a revenue on the one hand. The idea that those people who export the product into the US, they need to pay a levy, mm-hmm. and that to the US, and that's a revenue. But that assumes that those people take that to the detriment of their margin, right? There is no free money. It's just a shift. Now, if they don't want that, the idea is then that basically the product becomes more expensive, and it's actually the consumer who pays mm-hmm. the price. And right. that is why people call tariffs inflationary. There are others who said, no, tariffs are not inflationary because it simply reduces the amount of money people can spend. So if they spend more money on that, they have to spend less money on something else. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course, I think what the real reason is, he wants to use it as a way to negotiate better deals and longer term incentivize more production in the US. No, okay.
Sure.
But, you know, those are kind of my common sense thoughts. What are your thoughts, and how do you look at these mechanics?
I agree with everything you said. So yeah, in terms of the impact of tariffs on prices, yeah, typically they're quite inflationary, or I should say they raise the price level, even if the impact on inflation may drop out of the numbers 12 months after the imposition of the tariff. Our rule of thumb is that if you have a 10 percentage points increase in the average US tariff rate, core PCE inflation goes up by 0.1%. The base case from our research team is that tariffs rise by 10 percentage points. And so that means that the boost to core PCE price level is about 1%. To put that in context, this 10 percentage points increase is 5 times bigger than what we got during the first trade war in 2017 and 2018. The analysis of the first trade war suggests that tariffs are typically mostly passed on to the consumer. And I think the intuition is that import demand tends to be pretty inelastic. These consumers typically want those products. They don't have a lot of alternative options. And so they're, in economics, it's always the inelastic side that has fewer alternatives that tends to bear the burden. There are some exceptions. We, for instance, think that if there would be a tariff on Canadian oil, and with most Canadian oil sort of trapped in Canada, with pipeline export capacity constraints quite limited, with most of these barrels really going to Midwest refiners, we think actually that Canadian producers would bear most of the cost by reducing their margins. So typically the cost is on the consumer side, but again, as always, it depends on the details and sort of the relative bargaining position. In terms of the impact on the economy, the most important effect is a loss in real income and lower consumer spending. At the margin, higher import prices typically reduce imports and that boosts the trade balance. So there could be a small positive to GDP via a higher contribution from net exports, but typically over time, that effect fades as the exchange rate, interest rates, relative prices adjusts. And then to put it in perspective, it's unlikely to be a major revenue generator. And the reason is only 14% of US GDP corresponds to import. And so even if you raise tariffs by 10 percentage points, you're not raising more than 1.4%. We think that the mechanical effects of tariffs are not huge because mostly redistribution of income, as you said. The money is going to the government, and let's see what the government does with it. Do they give tax cuts? Do they spend more away from either consumers or producers? The big effects on growth really come from more psychological channels, a tightening what we call financial conditions. As we're seeing, equity markets, for instance, selling off, credit spreads widening, and that in turn then weighs on demand. And then the second more psychological channel is the fact that if there's high uncertainty, business leaders, they delay their investments. They want to see how the world is going to look like before buying new equipment, investing in software.
Great.
Thank you very much.
I heard people crying for not the Powell put, but the Trump put. And I heard today that Trump was inviting US business leaders explaining his economic policy and tariff policy. Now, suppose Mr. Salomon, the CEO of Goldman, is invited. What is his advice to the US administration with regards to what we just discussed?
That you should invite him.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you can help us, we would be delighted. But yeah,
I think the general view from our research team is that the Trump policy agenda has mixed effects on growth, with the costs being front-loaded and with some of the benefits typically happening later.
Yeah.
The major costs are the drag from tariffs via higher uncertainty and tighter financial conditions on growth in the short term. But that's probably already happening as we speak, because business leaders already suggest in surveys that uncertainty is very high and sentiment has turned less optimistic. While the benefits are typically more backloaded, we, for instance, assume that the tax cuts from the first Trump administration will be extended and will become a little bit bigger, but that will take time. Both, it takes time to pass it through Congress, it takes time for people to spend the extra money from the tax cuts. And we also assume, you know, some modest benefits from a more business-friendly regulatory framework. But again, that typically would support activity over time. And so I think, the upshot is that the costs are probably more front-loaded than the benefits. And I think the message from both consumer and business service is that there is a desire for somewhat greater policy clarity, as certainty is one important driver of CapEx decisions.
Yeah, maybe because we're coming to the end of the podcast, but I still would love to ask a more personal question to you. It's amazing, of course, the role you're in and probably things that you learn. But what did you learn from your best managers?
Yeah, great. Yeah, maybe I can go maybe through, three people that I worked with who had a very, very significant impact. My PhD advisor, Jim Poterba, who's both a macro and a microeconomist, he was very focused on me asking good questions. Like, if I can't formulate my research question in a clear question with like a yes, a no, or a number as an answer, he said, this is probably not worth your time. He was very focused on killing bad projects quickly. If you don't have an interesting question that you can formulate well, move on to your next question. So the importance of the question, that's what I learned from Jim, among many other things. Turning to Jan Hatzius, the Goldman chief economist and the head of research, who was my first manager at Goldman, I learned two things from him. Keep it simple, but also be precise. And how do you do that? By focusing on the channels that matter and recognizing that you're not quantifying the channels that are quantitatively much less important. And the second thing he said is, in the context of being a forecaster, when you're right, you're not a genius. When you're wrong, you're not an idiot. And just, focus on drawing lessons and try to learn from instances where the forecast is not going very well, and just, stay focused, stay humble, and stay focused on, improving the forecast and focus on the present and the future rather than the past. And then maybe the third thing I learned from Jeff Currie, the former head of Goldman Commodities Research, is that, and I think it relates to the European energy crisis, in order to correct physical imbalances in most commodity markets, you typically need very sharp price moves.
Correct.
And I think that's what we saw during the European energy crisis. It really took very high prices in both Asia and Europe for industrial energy intensive activity to moderate, and for instance, countries like Pakistan, India, to reduce their demand for natural gas. And because energy and commodities are such a basic need, typically the elasticity of demand is very small. We really need those commodities. And so in order to incentivize them to rebalance the market and adjust their behavior, you need typically massive swings. And that's the fundamental reason why commodity markets are so volatile and so fascinating. And so, thanks to Jeff for really ingraining this in the brain of our research team.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very well articulated. And that's, I call it the markets, the coffee markets, the cocoa markets, in a brutal way. It needs to happen in a brutal way to reprice.
It seems like that cocoa, for example, has you know, over the last years, it has never really took a hit on the demand side.
Mm, correct.
So somehow it's not brutal enough for us to not buy chocolate. We just love it
well,
too
that's,
much.
That, but that's why the price went so up, and eventually demand is declining.
But you see a switch in quality of the chocolate bar, or yeah, a bit of a change.
Yeah, reformulation.
Reformulation, yeah. All right.
Hey, the last question that I would like to raise, because it's a question that we always raise pretty much, because we have a lot of young people in the audience. So what is your advice to young people who would like to break into the commodities industry?
Yeah, number one, I think find a team, a role where you maximize your learning and where you enjoy maybe at least, you know, 60-70% of the tasks you're doing. Second, I think invest in your hard skills, you know, programming, applied econometrics. The third one is focus on making your team and your colleagues stronger. And the fourth one is find a couple of good mentors.
Excellent. That's a great end to the podcast. Thanks. Thanks a lot. It was fantastic.
Dan, really enjoyed. Thank you very much. And have a good one. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Have a great day. Yeah?
Bye-bye, Dan.
Bye.